Welcome to another episode of North American Deer Talk, where the fusion of facts and opinions become the education and entertainment for all. This is your host, Josh Newton, and we have another great show for you today. Hi, folks, and welcome back to the show. This is your host, Josh Newton. It is November 12th, 2015, and this is episode number 16. Today, we're going to talk about developing some long-term goals for breeding in the white-tailed deer industry. Let's go ahead and take care of our housekeeping. We'll start off with our first sponsor, and that is the Whitetail Guide. Now, the Whitetail Guide is a marketing company that directly targets the whitetail breeding industry. They publish a few different types of magazines and books. One's called their hardcover breeder book, breeder buck pedigree book, and then they have two magazines that they do. One's called the Super Doe magazine, and the other one's called the Fall Edition magazine. Now, the Whitetail Guide hardcover series, or their breeder buck book, started back in 2004. They were putting that together. Can you believe that? 2004. It's more than 10 years ago. And then volume one was published in 2005. It's really amazing to kind of look back and see how far our industry has come as far as the pedigrees we've been developing in these deer and some of the older pictures and such. It's really neat. If you get a chance, try to take a look at volume one sometime. The book generally consists of hundreds of the leading breeder bucks with their pictures, four-generation deep pedigrees, scores, owners' contact information, etc. They also publish the auction results for many of the major industry-leading auctions in the back of their book. So it's a great place to go when you're researching pedigrees and you find an animal you like. You can hop into the back and see what some of the lots that maybe that animal was in, sold for, etc. So it's a great tool as far as that goes. And it's also a great place to advertise your bucks for promotion of your farm. Now, the Super Doe magazine and the Fall Edition are both magazines that are sent out to their mailing list. And that mailing list is really extensive. It comprises of all the members of NADIFA, the Deer Breeders Co-op, the Texas Deer Association, and 17 other state associations. So it's a really comprehensive list of people that are active in the deer community within the North American Canada region, where we're all raising deer. In addition, they print they do their print publications. They also do email blasts, and they have other marketing solutions. So they started doing some graphic design. They also have ad design, promotional flyers. They do logos, booth displays, anything you can think of that kind of revolves around the advertising end of the whitetail deer business. Give Whitetail Guide a call. They'll take care of you. I've dealt with those guys over the past 5 or 10 years, and they're great to work with. If you want to get a hold of them, you can try them at 877-269-9091. That's the Whitetail Guide, and that's 877-269-9091. Our second sponsor today is going to be Cervid Solutions. They help make sure that this show is on the air for you guys to listen to. If you appreciate the work that we're doing here at North American Deer Talk, and you want to help support that show, make sure that you're buying some items from these sponsors. They offer some discounts once you're a member. You can end up saving a pretty substantial sum of money. So take advantage of those offers. Just go over to CervidSolutions.com, sign up for that membership program. It's real simple. Just click on that membership button, fill out a few of the quick little intro forms there, and you're all set to go. That takes care of our sponsors for today's show. I'm going to give you a quick farm update here at Red Ridge Whitetails, which is really the proving grounds or the testing grounds for all the protocols we develop for Cervid Solutions. Our AI program seemed to be pretty successful. Obviously, we won't know for a little bit, but it was everything went real smooth. Those seemed to handle fine. They seem to respond to our synchronization program that we put together real well. We did do some embryo work this year. I'll kind of throw my hands up in the air and say that it was successful. We did get some embryos out of some does, so that was a neat experience for us to do here. It was the first time that we've done it. I've been wanting to do it for the past 3 years, and I wasn't quite ready to take on that that program. But we got a protocol set up with Dr. Weiss and her team over there at ARC, or Applied Reproductive Concepts, and we put together what we thought was a successful program. As with any program, we always want to try to do better, and I think we have some data points that we can work from. And improve on that program. So we did implant some embryos here from one of our donors. We'll see how that works. It seems like the protocol that we set up for our recipient does, or our surrogate mothers, should be pretty excellent. So we're excited to see, you know, if those girls actually will carry a pregnancy from an embryo. But really interesting process. We documented the entire thing. We have video that we will be working on, getting that edited, and then that'll go up in the Cervid Solutions membership area. So if you're a member, you can take advantage of some professional quality video there and learn more about you know, embryo transfer and some of the protocols that we're developing and setting up. So that was a neat, I don't know another word to describe it. It was a neat process. It was enjoyable to do, and I'm glad we've done it. So we'll kind of go back and adjust some things, and we'll try to make it better for previous or for upcoming years. We're getting ready to run some Dauphins in the barn here. We're going to take weights. We're going to look at some pedigrees, and we'll decide who's going to get synchronized up to get bred. We do like to breed some of our Dauphins. We have some pretty large fawns as far as their size. And then, you know, I said we're going to look at pedigrees. We have pedigrees, obviously, on these animals, and we have certain lines that tend to be more early maturing, whether that be in the buck department or the does. We've had some lines that consistently fawn, you know, as fawns, or they get bred when they're, you know, 6 or 8 months old. They give us nice healthy fawns, so it's almost like a bonus deer, and it helps prove these does out, you know, a year ahead of time, which I think in today's marketplace there's something to be said about, you know, getting your animals proven out quicker, and you know, the more offspring you can get out of a doe in a shorter period of time, helps keep the cost down on things. You know, these guys, they tend to eat pretty good, and obviously that's slowed down here for us in the north, and they're going into more of a maintenance mode for the winter. But you know, I think we all can attest to how much feed these guys eat through, you know, July, August, September, and even into the first parts of October. It's pretty incredible what they can put away. So we're going to go ahead and probably put cedars in a few of those does. I know we have quite a few Dauphins that are over the 80-pound mark, and they'll be good candidates to get us a fawn, and sometimes even two. We've had fawns have twins before and, you know, take care of both the fawns and you know, make it to weaning time just fine. So we'll go ahead and do that. So that's pretty much the update. You know, we're just starting to get some of that crappy wet weather. It's pretty consistent for November. It's not super cold, but it's been raining here for the past, you know, 3 or 4 days, and it's just it's not incredibly nice outside to be out there, but it is what it is. So with that, we'll get into the main topic of our show today, and we'll talk about some of the standards and goals and things like that we can put together to have a successful long-term breeding program. And it's going to be a relatively quick show. I don't know, maybe it'll be 20-30 minutes, but just some thoughts I had here today that I wanted to share with you. So we'll get into that. So this topic will really start with a question, and the question is, how do we develop a long-term breeding goal? Well, I think we need to look at it from an outsider's perspective, first of all. So we need to have kind of a clear mind about this. And we want to start with a picture, and that picture can be whatever you want it to be, but I think the end goal for a lot of us is to really grow that perfect buck. So, there's a lot of factors that contribute into that, and we talk about the importance of does and things of that nature. But we'll try to look at this from an outsider's perspective, or someone that's maybe first starting or revamping a breeding program, something of that nature. So we have to start with this picture, and this picture needs to be the perfect deer in your mind. So whatever that is, and you want to try to develop that picture into something that's more permanent, because it will evolve in your mind if you keep it there. So try to put it on paper, maybe try to think of some pictures, things like that, draw it out, maybe have some criteria or something along those lines. But we have to start with that picture. Number two, we don't want to talk to anybody about our goals initially until that picture is drawn and it's set in stone and it's permanent. Now, it's not to say that that can't evolve down the road, but it needs to be a fixed point, with very little, iterations down the line. So I think we need, the importance of keeping it to yourself is, even though you may respect the opinions of others, which I certainly do, we need to have really an unbiased look at what we're trying to do. So, don't talk to anybody about it. Number three, we're going to have to compile a list of deer that you really like the look of. So, they can be wild deer. They can be animals within our industry. It doesn't matter, but once we have that picture built, we can start looking at other deer and saying, I really like the beam shape on this one, or I like the way the tines, kind of lay out a little bit towards the outside on this other deer. I like the mass on this one. Whatever that may be. I mean, everybody has a different idea of what's perfect, and really, I think the most intriguing thing about white-tailed deer is there's no two that are alike. You can have any sets of antlers and they're all unique in some way, shape, or form. I mean, we could be looking at just some 8-points and there might be 100 8-pointers for us to look at. And, even though there's a lot of similarities and there's not much going on, on a 4x4 mainframe rack, they're all different. So, and we each have our particular flavors of antler style that we like. So anyway, so compile a list of those deer that you like, write down the names, start doing the homework on them, find the pictures, and just get yourself a list. Pedigree does not matter. Just forget about pedigree. Just go 100% on looks. And then once you have that, you can go ahead and you can start putting all the pedigrees together for each one of those pictures, if they're available, and you can start making assessments of how those pedigrees are relating to the look of those antlers. So, there's certain there's certain genetic lines that have inherent traits that are just bred into those animals, and they pass them down generation over generation, and we see that with some of the older herds. So when you're doing, I guess we'll call this the homework aspect of the plan, when you're putting that data together and you're actually looking at it and you're trying to assess it and come up with these similar traits, you can look at certain genetic lines or even those genetic crosses to find those traits. And you'll see them over and over again. And, there might be some that you don't like. You'll have to discount those lines regardless of if you think that those are maybe popular lines or they're having They're having great value within the market at this particular time. You know, you have to be really critical at this point in the game. And we'll get to some options later, but you have to be critical when you're starting to keep the majority, 90% of your herd based around what you like. You can experiment down the road, but if you're having a goal that you're putting in place, you have to be really rigid within within that goal. So otherwise you'll never meet it. It'll keep being there, and you'll keep trying to adjust it and thinking you're meeting that goal, but you really won't. So you're just doing yourself a disservice. So anyway, so assessing those pedigrees is important. And then you're going to ask, once all that's done, you have a pretty good data set there to look at. You have lots of deer that you like. You found some pedigree lines and genetic lines that interest you. You need to go talk to people that do not necessarily have those genetic lines, or deer that are opposite of them, and get as much information on that as you can, and ask them, you know, why they have a particular type of deer as far as their look, and you know what their plans are, and try to get as many of those opinions from those people as you can, and try to document this as much as you can. You know, take notes if you're on the phone, or if you're sitting down having a chat with them, just say, hey, do you mind if I take some notes and just jot some things down while we're talking? You know, most people they won't have any issue with that. You know, if you tell them what you're trying to do and you're just trying to get some opinions, I think that's a great thing. That's how we all can grow. And maybe during your conversation, maybe they'll start thinking about, you know, differently about some of the questions that you're asking, and it'll be good for both of you. So anyway, once you've talked to the people that you feel are raising the kind of deer that maybe you don't want to, or that aren't as appealing to you as the other ones, go to the people that have those genetic crosses that you like and that have the type of deer that you like as well, and talk to them about where they got them, how they're performing for them, you know, how long they've had them, maybe some of the reproductive rates, et cetera, and really get a sense of feeling for that particular look, how it's developing, and just as much background info as you can. I think it'll be beneficial. Again, take notes. People will be more than happy to give you that information. Looking at the successes of these other farms and these lines will lend you insight into maybe where you want to go, or help you further develop your plan to getting there. So we want to look at farms. You know, I think we do ourselves a disservice. Not that people that have only been raising deer for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, not that they don't have excellent deer. They're still in the process of developing their program. So really at this point in time, you know, they're just really breeding deer. You know, they're still feeling out a lot of these animals. And you know, anybody that really buys animals, it's the same thing. I mean, we still buy animals. We have the bulk of our herd on our farm, and we don't typically incorporate new genetics through semen. But we still buy some does here and there, or maybe a breeder buck or something along those lines that'll help, you know, influence our farm. But we really need to look at those farms that have been in business, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. And as you go up in that age range, as far as the farm's been in business, the numbers decrease drastically. I mean, there's just not a lot of guys that have been raising deer for 30 years. You can probably count them on, you know, both hands, maybe a couple more hands, but they're few and far between. I think those are the guys that you really want to inquire with and try to develop relationships and spend time with them, because their insights into what they've learned from their deer are very different from the insights that that we learn today. And what I mean is, 30 years ago, there really wasn't artificial insemination. We had single sire breeding was just starting to come about. I mean, guys literally would have 20 does in a pen. They'd throw $2 or $3 in there because they wanted them all to get bred. I mean, could you imagine doing that today? It'd just be chaos. I mean, the bucks would be fighting all the time, and it would be a mess. You wouldn't know who the fawns were out of, you know, when they're born. And I mean, just, it was a guessing game. So we've just taken some simple common sense approaches like single sire breeding, to better our herds. But, you know, back in the day, the resources, and I don't mean financially, I mean, as far as number of deer to pick from, were not there. I mean, there was only a few deer in the country that were, you know, what we would consider average today, you know, 200 inches. I mean, a 200 inch deer 25 years ago or 20 years ago was, I mean, it was almost unheard of. So, I mean, some of the, at least from the north, I'm not too up on my Texas history, but I can speak from some of the past experiences here in the north, you know, like, Bucky, for instance, up at Wilderness Whitetail, certainly, you know, a legend in the industry. Well, you know, he was born in 1996. You know, that's 19 years ago, 20 years ago. Sundance from Bond Trigger's place. You know, same year, PA Geronimo, same time. You know, all these industry leading kind of bucks that really kind of shaped and forged what the northern market was all about. They're all born in the late 90s. You know, mid to late 90s. Well, you know, by the time that those deer got to 200 inches, it was maybe 99, 2000. I mean, that's only 15 years ago to think about it. It's not that long, but, you know, think about the guys 15 years prior to that. You know, having a breeder buck, you know, it might be a 170-inch four-year-old. So talking to them about what they saw and what they did to develop those herds, you know, seeing if they have records to look at. You know, there wasn't, I mean, it's not like digital cameras existed. There's a lot of 35 millimeter, film, looking at old pictures. It's just that kind of history is really important, I think. So I didn't mean to get off on a tangent, but it was something to consider, you know, talking to these guys that have done this for a long time. They have so much as far as the resources and their thought processes over the years that, number one, it makes for a fascinating conversation, and you know, you get to learn a lot. So, anyway, get a chance to do that. The next thing we need to look at is, you know, we've done all the steps, getting your picture made, and talking to these people, and making this list, and really having this great. It's an idea at this point. There's a couple more little building blocks that we need to put into that till we can implement it. One is, do we want to grow, typical or non-typical deer? And I think this question is going to rage on for, you know, till the end of time, when we're breeding these deer. A lot of guys, at least what I'm seeing, is they're losing sense of what is typical and what is non-typical. And when a deer is you know, has a nice open look, and let's just say it has a, you know, a 220 inch mainframe, and it has another 100 inches of extras, that is not a typical deer. I don't care if it's beautiful or perfect, and we need to stop calling them typicals. You know, it's a tough thing to do, because, you know, we're just missing one word. It's typical frame. You can have the biggest non-typical gnarly looking thing with a huge typical frame. That's possible. I've seen it before. We've grown one that had a 229 6/8 inch mainframe. He scored like 335 or something like that. He wasn't particularly pretty that year, but he had a monster mainframe. So we just need to identify. We need to come up with certain terminology to have you know, within our industry to say, hey, this is a typical, this is a non-typical, this is a, you know, a typical frame with extras, however that is. But I would say, you know, a typical deer would be less than 10% of its score comes from non-typical inches. I think we're at a point in the industry where we can say that would be considered a typical for us. You know, I think that's a good standard to set. Anyway, so the reason that we need to know if we want to grow typicals or non-typicals, and I don't mean to have a farm that is exclusive to one or the other. I mean, I really like the typicals. I think it's at this point in the industry, I think it's a much tougher challenge to grow consistently a quality group of typicals. But we still have, you know, we've allocated X amount of our program, a percentage of our does that we breed every year. We allocate them to a non-typical, and it doesn't mean that they can't have a huge typical frame or a great look or be awesome deer. We're trying not to base our entire program on that. So you need to come up with some sort of strategy or plan to make that happen. The second thing is as far as your time and your inputs into your farm, I can tell you with absolute certainty that if you do any type of traveling or you go anywhere over the summer months and you leave your bucks, a typical deer will handle themselves much, much better with the least amount of intervention compared to a group of non-typical bucks. You can ask anybody that has grown a bunch of big deer in one season, and number one, it's stressful because you're always looking. Those deer are ever evolving. I mean, some of those non-typicals, they'll grow 5-6 inches a day sometimes. I mean, that's a lot, but even, you know, 2 to 3, I mean, there's consistently changes. So you're looking for particularly antler damage. I mean, it happens. They nick up a tine. There's so much blood going into those antlers, and they're growing so well that, you know, you end up having to knock them down and, you know, just make sure that there's not an infection going to fester in there or anything. So it's not to say that a typical can't do that. I've certainly seen that happen, but it's just, there's so much more going on with the non-typicals that they just, you're going to have to interject. You know, if you have to knock down, you know, 10 of them, you might have to only knock down one typical. So, and it could be more than that. So we need to look at how much of those inputs do you want to put in. You know, I think the more hands-off approach is probably better overall for everybody. It's better for the deer. It's better for the people working. And it just makes things a lot more enjoyable. So I think that kind of wraps up exactly on how to kind of develop that long-term breeding goal. Now, we didn't touch on, you know, specific genetic lines, so to speak, but we've given you the parameters to make that happen. And you can start putting that exercise together and doing all that. It's kind of fun to do, even if you've been, you know, raising deer for 20 years. So we'll get into kind of the second part of this long-term breeding goal, and that's what do we actually have to look for in these animals as far as antlers, reproduction, body conformation, etc. Before we talk about those specific things, I'm just going to I'll make a statement, and I think this is you know, good words of wisdom. If you're going to make an investment into a particular genetic line, and when I mean investment, I'm talking about a substantial sum of money, and that may be different for everyone, but proportionally speaking to you, if it makes you mildly uncomfortable, even though you might be happy about it, if it makes you uncomfortable to write that check or spend that money, you need to go to the farm and you need to see those animals on the hoof. Need to stop buying pieces of paper at auctions or you know, not doing your due diligence to look at certain genetics lines. So, you know, if somebody is going to invest in a particular line, I think it's wise to go to that person's farm that you're considering investing that money in, looking at those animals, making sure that they have the attributes collectively that you want. Now, you know, when we set our standards up for our animals, you know, the easiest thing for us to do, at least with our does, is to look at their body conformation. Now, the toughest thing that we all have to do is we have to use these does to make bucks because we're trying to grow these nice antlers. Well, obviously the does don't have antlers, so it's an incredibly difficult task. But spend more than an hour at the farm, talk to these people, try to get as much information out of these farmers that you can. And then, you know, maybe look at some of those genetics on other farms and see if they match up. So anyway, it's just, you know, I think doing any type of purchasing on a large scale or getting into some long-term investment type things, you need to look at those animals. It's really important. So we'll get in. I have a couple of my criteria here for some of the standards that we've set in place. And I think that these are just kind of the, you know, the benchmarks that we want to reach each and every time. It doesn't mean, and we kind of do the 90-10 rule, 85-15, something like that, where we want, again, to create consistency long-term in our herd. We want to have the largest group of these animals reach these standards. So every once in a while, we'll get attached to a pedigree or something will go wrong as far as development in an animal physically, that it doesn't reach these standards, and we'll still end up keeping it. And that's fine. We just don't want to venture so far out off of the road that, you know, half of our herd is not meeting these standards. So as far as females go, this is just going to be based off body weight. We want our Dauphins of the same year. So this year, let's say the 2015 Dauphins, we want them at least 70 pounds by November 1st. We want our year and a half olds, and these are all minimum standards. I didn't write out what I would consider my averages or my high end, but I know we've had Dauphins in the 90 pound range already. So, you know, 70 is probably on the high end for our standards. And again, we can adjust a little bit from there, but you know, that's kind of the benchmark. 120 pounds for year and a half old or first breeding season animals. So that would be this year, that would be your 2014 animals. We want them at a minimum of 120 pounds. We had, what did we breed? Maybe three or four this year. Smallest one was 139. There was two that were in the 140s. I think the one was like 147 and the other was 149. So I was really pleased with that for year and a half old does. They're excellent size. They have great conformation. The one is a big, tall, long, lean thing. So she's going to be a monster when she's older. And she should be, because her mom was 196 pounds in the fall. And, you see that pass down. So anyway, 2.5-year-old does, we want them to be about 140 pounds. And from 3.5 till, you know, they're mature up on, we want them about 150 or larger. So, you know, if we have 3- and 4-year-old does that are in that 150 to 160 range, that's a good solid average. I've seen a lot of does that are built very nice in that range. The ideal weight for me here is 170 pounds or bigger. I'd really like to see, you know, the core of my mature does on my farm at over 170 pounds. I think out of the, we AI'd 12, we did 12 does here. Two of them weren't mine that we bred. 11 were, and I know that we had, as far as the AI program, I know that we had one was over 190 pounds. One was 178. I'm just doing this off my head. I have it on my sheet over in the handling facility, but I don't have it here. And I know another one was over 170. I'm trying to think if there's any other ones. I don't believe so. So we had, you know, three. Those might be the only mature does we had. We had one other mature doe that was in the 160 pound range. But so all of our mature does were over 160, which is good. And 75% of those were over 170 pounds. So I think if we took an average, it would be in that mid 170 range. So Anyway, those are the standards that we have for the females. Sorry to get off track. As far as the males go, again, these are just some parameters that we put in place. We want our year. I don't have body weights for the buck fawns. They range anywhere from 80 to 100 pounds on average. You know, we're good with that number. I'm fine with that, and I'm not necessarily calling out a 50 pound, you know, buck fawn in November, because I've seen those little guys grow, and then you know, they turn into, you know, a quality stalker buck. So no issues there. Anyway, males, a year and a half old, we want them at 180 pounds by October 15th. And this standard is just for breeder bucks. This is not for, you know, our ranch bucks that we're keeping separate, just for breeders. So, we want them at 180 pounds or better. Most of the ones that we've seen, like our upper tier, you know, bucks at a year and a half old have been in that 200, 210 pound range, give or take. We've seen quite a few that, we had a couple at, you know, 198, 199, and then on up from there. 2.5 year olds by October 15th, we want them in the 220 pound range. 3 year olds, we want in the 240 plus pound range by October 15th. So, again, those are pretty easy. I think those are for northern deer. Those are pretty easy tags to hit. You know, as long as those animals have been healthy their whole life and they've had proper development, I don't think it'll be an issue. Now, just as an overall look, and this we'll wrap the show up with this. I prefer a more thoroughbred type look for my breeder bucks. And what do I mean like that? I mean that I would much rather see younger animals. 1, 2, and 3 year olds with a more tall, lean look with good bone structure. So I want to see, some higher hips. I want to see, you know, good solid shoulders, nice chest conformation. I'm not a fan, I guess, of the year and a half olds that have, unless they're just absolute, you know, monster specimens, have a straight belly. All the way across, I like to see it kind of come up a little bit more like the, you know, the thoroughbred look of a horse. But I want to see that good bone structure. I want to see big hoofs, you know, big knobby knees, a big head, you know, again, good chest conformation, long, you know, long loins on them. All those things are good, because as those animals develop and mature, they have the bone structure in place to put on a lot of beef. So, you know, we might have an animal that is, I don't know, 160 pounds as a yearling, but it's big, tall, it's kind of lean, it's still growing a lot. You know, just like a teenager when they're getting their growth spurt, you know, they're all legs and arms, kind of same type of thing. comparing them to another buck that may be shorter in stature, but a lot more round. You know, when those bucks are 4 years old, I can promise you that thoroughbred is going to be a hoss compared to the other one. That other one might be a butterball, but I don't necessarily want to breed those traits, the butterball traits, into my animals. I want the bone structure, because they will develop more. They have bigger lungs because they have more capacity within their chest. They have bigger heart. They're able to pump that blood around and absorb oxygen into their body, which means the bucks are going to grow better antlers. The does, when they have that large conformation, they typically produce better milk. And we got to remember that lactation and milk production, they need the minerals in their body. Same thing with growing antlers. And that comes from the bone structure. Those calcium and phosphorus deposits, and other minerals are pulled from the bone structures of the animals and then put into growing antlers and milk. Now, obviously, we're meeting some of those needs with nutritional nutritional requirements, but if they have more bone in their body, they're going to be able to draw more. So they're going to nurse better. The does are going to have an easier time giving fawns because they have a much, you know, wider birth canal and pelvic area. So all good things to consider, but, you know, start taking a look at some of these animals and setting up the standards, which you think, will do well for you. And with that, we'll wrap up the show today. If you appreciate the work we're doing over here at Cervid Solutions and North American Deer Talk, head over to the website, sign up to be a member. We'd love to have you as part of our community here and certainly appreciate the support. And with that, as always, stay tuned for another episode of North American Deer Talk.